Hello, and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo, episode 446. I am your host, James Jones. With me today, Mr. John Lindemann.
I'm back.
He is back.
Another streak begins.
Another streak. Also with me today, Mr. Guillaume Veillette.
Yep, always streaking.
That's worse. All right, and last but not least, Mr. Greg Leahy.
It still sounds wrong when you say, I am your host, James Jones.
Sorry. You think it sounds wrong to hear? Imagine saying it.
I haven't got used to it yet. I adapt to circumstances very slowly. That is not a secret.
We are now entering the ice age of Radio Free Nintendo. So, got a good show this week, I'm hoping. I'm going to be positive and say we got a good show this week, but if it's bad, just leave it as I'm hoping. But first, before we got started into new business, I wanted to go ahead and reveal the winner of our Mario Maker, not featured in Mario Maker, poll for the next retroactive, which we then, after announcing, retroactively downgraded to a retroactive junior, which means it'll only be about one segment, and we'll probably be working on a fairly compressed timeline, but we'll announce the details of when we're going to do it next week. I just need some time to plan it. So that's fine. So if you don't remember, our four candidates were, well, first, the criteria was a game that was easily available that was not featured in Mario Maker. And then we got so many suggestions from you that we ended up saying, well, we'll do some of these other games in different retroactives. We're going to pick four games. And then for some reason, about an hour into a recording session, we said, let's pick games. I'm sure we won't make terrible decisions. And then we picked Mario Tennis Power Tour for the Game Boy Advance, Mario Party Advance for the Game Boy Advance, Mario Pinball Land for the Game Boy Advance, and Super Smash Bros. For the N64. And what I believe is the most votes we have ever received in a retroactive poll, 145 votes. The winner is Mario Tennis Power Tour, Mario Pinball Land, and Super Smash Bros. For the N64. We have a three-way tie. And Mario Party Advance is only three votes behind them.
Oh, my God. Are we prepared for this? I don't think that we have any protocol in terms of what happens. We have
never had a three-way tie before.
Oh, well, we have to resolve this.
I should have given you these guys warning, but I wanted to get their reaction authentic.
Yeah, I figured, we had some advance warning that it could possibly end in a tie, but none of us ever fathomed that this doomsday scenario would occur.
So, briefly, because I was the only person who could see the voting totals, and briefly, about a couple days ago, it was looking perilously close to a four-way tie, and we briefly had it. And I thought, oh no. So then I started promoting it, and then Mario Party Advance took the lead, and then I stopped promoting it. Because that's a scenario that I wasn't ready for. And then about an hour before we were recorded, it jumped into a three-way tie. And then nothing happened. So, this is our scenario. So, gentlemen, how do we want to settle this? I am not a dictator. I'm a firm believer in the democratic process. And since we all have to play this, what do we want to do?
I'm going in with Mario Tennis on the proviso that we can rope Stan into it somehow.
That's true. You know what? That's a compelling argument. John, how you feeling?
I could do tennis. I can do that.
Guillaume?
I've played it before. I voted for Pinball Land, but I could play again. It's been a while.
All right. As the host and as the person who could see the votes, I'm not going to vote. And therefore, I guess we'll do Mario Tennis. I had additional information, so it's not fair for me to go out there and push that. I'm the only person who voted knowing what the current tallies were, so.
Yeah, I didn't vote either, but for the record, I would have voted for Mario Party Advance.
Thankfully, we still wouldn't have had Mario Party Advance win.
Technically, all of you should have been comfortable with those games, considering you decided on the big nominees without me. I'm the only one that would have the right to get pissy about Mario Party winning.
We just like to live dangerously. We wanted to add some spice to the vote. Yeah.
I would argue we live recklessly.
Yeah. Yep.
It was 37-37-37-34, which is unbelievable. Like, that is remarkably close. So, I want to thank everybody who submitted games. Like I said, we've got plans for some of the other games that you all submitted. John's never played Mario Galaxy 2. I'm serious.
I have played it. For about 5 minutes. I mean...
Oh. So you got the first star and you talked to the rabbit. John's talked to the rabbit in Mario Galaxy 2. So don't be surprised if that one pops in by fiat sometime soon. And a lot of other games were suggested. Some of them we'd actually played before. But, you know, well, there'll be more Mario in Retroactives. This is a Nintendo podcast.
And also, we might get more nominees as more games become available. Like, over here, they just did Mario vs. DK 1 and 2. On the Virtual Console, you know, so like that, those could have been candidates.
They definitely would have been candidates.
Had they been available in, you know, across the region. So obviously, Nintendo of America doesn't have the best record on this sort of stuff.
Right.
Actually being that timely relative to Europe. But yeah, in the months hence, we might get some new nominees. I'm kind of hoping for Super Princess Peach. I like that nomination.
We just can't get it.
I hope they release that, the Tosei. Platform, I believe. I think Tosei.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah, like the Starfy games, which was, I think, going to be one of the earlier examples of a return for the Koopa Kids, but it got nixed for some reason.
Weird.
Yeah, but yeah, we've got plenty more possibilities.
Yeah, there will be more Mario.
Except for Mario Party Advance, that goes into the singularity and never comes back.
I mean, technically, it is a candidate for the second place poll because it technically got second place.
There's an insult to second places everywhere.
God. So, it's time for new business. Guillaume.
So, I've been playing the Legend of Legacy demo. It came out on the 22nd of September. And so that gave me a couple of... Yeah, the demo did. And so that gave me a few hours to play through what it has to offer. What's cool about the demo is that, like the Etrian Odyssey demos, your save carries over to the full game. So if you decide to try it out, you're not going to be doing the same thing once you buy the game. You won't be going through the same area and get bored by it. You can just carry on. So that's pretty cool. So the demo seems to be the beginning of the game, and I don't know if it explains less than the full game does, but boy, does it not explain the system. I guess I should have seen this coming. I mean, Matsura used to develop the most, how would you say this, like not obscure, but the
obtuse?
Most opaque. Yeah,
esoteric. Like,
esoteric Final Fantasy games for Square, and he made the Saga games, which I know some people revile. I have fond memories of Final Fantasy Legend.
just drop the defense in there right now.
Yeah, well, you know, like I played the Game Boy games, and I liked them at the time, but I've never played the PlayStation games that came over here, and I hear that they're, I don't know, people really, really hate them. Yeah, so it was to be expected, but thankfully... it's not that opaque, like it's not that confusing. It's just it doesn't really tell you things that it should be telling you. But then like, you can just mess around with it a little bit in combat, and then if you've got a question, you can look up. There's a small online manual, like you can just press the home button and check the info that they've got there. It's probably not the full manual, but it's enough to understand. Like, oh, okay, so that's why my stats are going up this way and that. So this is an RPG, and unlike other RPGs, you don't get experience points when you kill creatures, and there's no, like, you don't see a progress bar showing you, like, oh, this skill's about to level up, or anything like that. The game just seemingly, at random, tells you, okay, so this character's SP has increased, this character has more HP now, this attack is now stronger. And what the manual tells you is that, there's a direct link, actually, between the attacks that you use and how they level up. Like you've got 8 different weapon types, and when you use a weapon, then basically randomly you may or may not like learn a new ability for it or increase the strength of the ability you just used. So there's a very direct link there. Like if you equip your guy with a sword, he's going to learn sword techniques and he's going to improve his sword techniques. Where it gets a little bit less obvious is that in battle, you've got a party of 3, and you've got different stances for each character, and you can set up formations. And each individual character can be defensive on the attack or support. And so you can configure different formations with that, like you'll have your your healer in a support stance, and you'll have the guy with the shield in the defensive stance, and the guy with the shield is going to block most of the attacks for the whole party. The support character is going to be a little bit quicker with the healing spells, and then you might have someone else on the offensive who's going to hit stronger but be more exposed. So it all makes sense once you know that's what's happening. It's just that the game doesn't really tell you. Mm. And the thing with the stances is that's what determines if your attack is going to increase, if your defense is going to increase, if your HP is going to increase.
It's not just your skills, it's how you approach battle.
Right. Like, it's not by attacking that you're going to improve your attack. Like, you're going to improve your skills with a weapon, but your attack stat for the character is not going to increase. What increases that stat is being in the offensive stance. So it's just a good thing to know, right? And the game is like, didn't really feel like telling you.
Figure it out.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you could figure it out, though, with time? Like, it's something that as you got comfortable with the game, you would have the opportunity to figure out?
Well, I don't know. I don't see the point. Like, I mean, I don't know. I think it would have felt random. Like, why didn't that skill just go up?
Okay.
Like, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out if the game becomes approachable with time or not necessarily.
But it is approachable. It's just you have to read the manual. And what I've just told you is what the manual contains. So it's just.
So Guillaume has just spared you reading.
Yeah, basically.
Why read?
That's right.
Yeah, exactly. That's for suckers. But that's why we podcast.
We call this illiteracy rainbow over in here.
As for the game itself, it's pretty cool. Like, I like the look. The 3D effect is non-existent almost. It just makes your image blurrier, so I turned it off. It's kind of a disappointment. But the look of it, the style, kind of looks... When you're in exploring, not dungeons, but kind of like of forests what? And stuff like that, the world, things just pop out in front of you. Like the trees just show up like in a pop-up book. So it's kind of cool effect that you've got the map on the bottom screen at all times. So it's not obnoxious. Like, it's not like, oh, I was heading there, but turns out it's a forest. It's a wall and I can't go there. Like, you can see where you're going. It's just this neat effect of things springing up in front of you. In the town, it's got this kind of like, I don't know, kind of sketch look to it, kind of like hand-drawn, except that the town is 3D-ish. Like, you can see they're using polygons, but they went and put like kind of a tracing around these rocks over here, and like pastel colors. Like, it looks very hand-drawn.
It's got style.
And I'm loving the music. Some people disagree. Like, I've heard some people are like, wow, this battle theme is boring me to tears, but I like it. It's the same composer as Final Fantasy XIII, which I liked enough the soundtrack of. The game, though, doesn't seem to use fully the good ideas that it has. There's no random battles. You can see the enemies on this field, but you can't ambush them. Like, you can't try to surprise them by attacking them from behind. Like, you won't gain the upper hand by doing that. They never really seem to run away when you're too strong for them, at least not so far. Maybe later in the game, if there's a big enough difference, but so far they just, like, they see you and they're gonna run after you, and you can try to outrun them as far as long as you can, and some enemies you can outrun, some you can't. It's just like, okay, cool, so you're letting me see these enemies, but I don't know, like, they didn't take the best practices of other RPGs that let you see the enemies on the field, you know? They could have gone, like, you know, borrowed some ideas from Earthbound, say, but they didn't. And, and similarly, you don't always get cash when you finish a battle. The way that you get most of your cash, it seems, is by selling items, but also by filling up these maps. Once you fill them up completely, they are more valuable. So you sell that info to the in the town, and that's how you make the bulk of your money. But again, you know, like, while I like the idea, this tying exploration to a reward, I don't think that they really go far enough with it, because the exploration in itself is not that interesting. You know, it's not Xenoblade. It's more Diablo, I would say. You know, with elements of background that are repeated over and over again. So, like, you go around the map and eventually you've covered the whole floor. Congratulations. Now do it with another screen, with another floor. And there's no real unique elements to it. There's no, you know, Xenoblade, there's actually, like, vistas. You know, there's stuff to explore, to look at. There's unique, yeah, it's a world. In this case, it's more like, yeah, okay, so we put this kind of fountain here, and it's very much the same fountain that you've seen in other floors and other screens, but, you know, here's one more. Enjoy.
This place looks familiar.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, the focus, it seems to be more on the combat and, than the exploration, I would say. So yeah, I don't really have that much more to say about it. Like, other than the character progression stuff, it's fairly straightforward. I feel like you basically know what you're getting into. There's stuff about these kind of elementals that you befriend that I haven't explained, but again, that stuff is in the digital manual, so you can look it up. And,
oh, so now we have to read. Thanks, Guillaume. So let me ask you this.
Yes.
I have a pre-order for this game already. Not because it saved me money to do it that way, not because I encourage pre-ordering. I don't.
Sure.
Should I hold that pre-order?
Well, you should play the demo. I mean, as I said...
I get that. I'm just trying to get... If you were in my position right now, would you hold the pre-order?
I also pre-order to save money. Oh, and okay. I'm keeping this pre-order, and I'm probably dropping Yo-Kai Watch because...
Oh, no.
I don't like level 5 games other than Dragon Quest.
So you said Yo-Kai, the level... Oh, man. All right.
Anyway,
that's a smart decision. I encourage your decision.
Yeah, that's a good life choice is what I would call that.
Yeah, probably.
I mean, that game's still level 5. It should be called level 6.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
And I enjoy...
I'm sorry.
I enjoy what I played of the demo. I finished it just while we were talking about the poll, actually. I finally beat the boss that it put in my way. And I enjoy it. And I'm looking forward to playing more of it.
Good.
Like, the demo doesn't tell you everything. But I'm looking forward to see what the final product looks like.
Cool. All right, so next up. Oh, it's me, actually. Me and Greg.
No.
I wrote these show notes, all right? I just come back from the gym. I was tired. So next up, I'm going to talk about the DLC, free DLC, mind you, add-on to Shovel Knight, which was one of my favorite games of last year, the Plague of Shadows add-on, which lets you, as you might infer, play as Plague Knight. So they had... This game had a lot of stretch goals in this Kickstarter campaign. I mean, a staggering number of them because its Kickstarter campaign was so unbelievably successful. I mean, not by the standards we judge them now, where you have things that, you know, blow through numbers that make no sense. But at the time, it was really a cut above anything we had seen in the Kickstarter world. And they kept adding these campaigns, and one of the ones they added was you play through the story, or a modified version of the story, as one of the knights, the 8 bosses of the game, and that they would, you know, create a slightly different story, and they would play differently based on what character it was, and they had votes as to which one it was going to be. They actually ended up funding 3 of those, but I don't think I've heard about them doing 2 more of these yet. But the first one... The first, and as far as I know, the only one announced so far, was to play as Plague Knight, which, if you recall from the game, if you played it, he is a small guy in a cloak and a plague mask who throws exploding potions. I mean, that's essentially what he is. So if you can imagine a game that was very kinetic in Shovel Knight, and you try to restructure the whole gameplay around this very different style of character... it's kind of amazing that they pulled it off. They had to redo a lot of the levels slightly to make it work, but the general themes have all preserved well, and it feels really good. As opposed to having, you know, the nice clean jumps that Shovel Knight has, the ability to bounce on the tip of his shovel, Plague Knight has essentially a jump, a double jump, and an attack, and the charge attack is essentially a third jump. So you're kind of working those things sort of in tandem with one another. On top of that, because he is an alchemist, that is what he does, whereas in Shovel Knight you would buy all kinds of doodads to increase stats and health and stuff like that. Plague, you buy components for his alchemy that he then uses in bomb making. So if you want to have the bombs go up, you know, right, he throws his basic bomb, he throws on a parabolic arc, it bounces a couple times, it explodes. And you can spam like three of them. But there's all sorts of weird combinations you can do where you can make them like cling to the wall and tread up until they hit something. You can make them sort of, you can make it so they just stop dead when they hit the ground. You could throw up to three and they get, they essentially cause exponentially larger explosions based on how many you've stacked. Yeah, they have ones that bounce more. They have ones that go in a high arc and blow up about two thirds of the way down. Then there's different formulations of what they do, you know, what the explosion does and stuff like, and how long they take to explode, things like that. Additionally, there's these casings, which are what happens when you release the charge. The basic one is you get a third jump. I spent a lot of time using one that lets him hover after you release it. So he goes up.
It's very helpful at first.
It's incredibly helpful.
It's a weird thing because you start off the game, you know, he's kind of more aerially mobile than Shovel Knight in a way, but it kind of makes doing some of the simple stuff in the levels a lot harder than it used to be. So it kind of feels like having your legs tied together or something. But once you get the float, you can kind of lean on that, at least in certain situations, because obviously you don't have to use it all the time. You can just swap it out of the menu.
Right.
And, you know, eventually you get to grips with it, and with all these options, he's incredibly versatile. I mean, I mean, sometimes it's kind of, I just had to kind of stop myself from changing, like, the weapon or the attacks or whatever, like, every other screen, just because, you know, you could do, because, you know, there's something probably works better every time, you know, but.
Yeah, I mean.
It's very, whereas Shovel Knight was very methodical. In the sort of tradition of, you know, classic Castlevania, Mega Man, you know, as you, not, you know, exactly the same as those, obviously, but had a lot of that sort of sensibility about it. Here you have a character that's unwieldy in a way, but also way more powerful and versatile. So it creates quite a different feel to the gameplay.
One thing that I walked away from at the very beginning, and I was incredibly frustrated before I had the hover, was like, so where a Shovel Knight, if there was an enemy below you mid-jump, that dude is dead. Because you just press the down button, you're done. Like, and you're gonna get another jump out of it. There's a very early part of the game where they were teaching Shovel Knight how to do that. And I could not stick the landing as Plague Knight because there's an enemy who is essentially the size of the platform.
Yeah, I know exactly the bit you're on about. This gave me some trouble too. It wasn't until I kind of got it so that I kind of overjumped it slightly, but then maintained my position in the air by throwing more bombs.
Right, because as you throw them, you sort of hover.
Yeah, not perfectly, but you kind of maintain your height for a little bit longer. And, you know, as long as you hit the enemy and kill it while you're doing that, then you can land on the platform safely. Because the thing is, sometimes you can be kind of, especially with some of the later power-ups, you could be bouncing around really happily. And you're like, oh, yeah, this is great. Actually, this is way easier than it was with Shovel Knight. And then something hits you in midair, and the enormous knockback just like, that's the end of that. You know, so it's not simultaneously, but it can very quickly go from being sort of tremendously empowering to just downright humiliating.
Oh, yeah. So I was sort of torn between, so in Shovel Knight, you had these armors you buy from the armorer because everybody's name is essentially what they do. And in this case, you get them from the Triple Fish, which gives you these healing power ups Plague Knight very often when he finds a Shovel Knight item, just goes, I have no use for this, which I thought was funny. So like he'll find all Shovel Knight's power ups and he'll go, what a piece of junk! I bet somebody will pay good money for this, and then he just tosses it in his bag and goes on. So you go through these really complicated processes of getting to these things that in the core game were, you know, really complicated challenges that had great rewards, and this one the rewards a bit more obtuse because you can trade them to the Chester who lives in a chest, because again, everyone's name is their job. Yep. And then he gives you an item that Plague Knight can use, but did a very good job sort of recrafting not just the levels, but the world. So, you know, his his impetus to action is kind of appropriate in a way, but also, you know, it sort of gives characterization to him. You know, it's not, he obviously is not to save the world because he doesn't care. He makes bombs for a living. That is what he does. But there is this sort of like very conscious effort to remake the game, but in a very minor way. So it still feels like the same game, but yet it feels as if the game was almost built for this character. It's a very impressive feat of adapting a very different character to the game mechanics of, you know, an already established and very good game.
I would say it's a fun kind of remix, you know, of the game, that creates some surprisingly kind of different challenges to it and a different kind of fun. Like I said, you know, it sort of changes the kind of core sensibility of the game. And it gives them the chance to do some more fun kind of references to video game history with some of his weapons. You know, there's a few that reference Mega Man weapons.
Yep.
One of the burst attacks is kind of a limited version of the screw attack, which is, you know, a very cool kind of Metroid. Anytime you can get that kind of Metroid reference, obviously it's not the full god mode screw attack.
No.
Otherwise it would just break the game. But, no, it's, I played through it all the way through, beat the final boss last night. I haven't got all those cypher coins to get his last ability.
Oh my god.
Yeah, I wonder what that is, because so many of them have been fun and amusing. I would like to know what it is, but I don't know that it's necessarily worth go back through all the levels to get like the one or two coins per level that I missed.
Yeah, and that's the thing. So there's these coins you collect that you then trade to, the potion maker from the game, who you encounter in the basement of the diner, or of the inn when you're playing a Shovel Knight. And that's how you get access to your power-ups. But like, there's so many of them in the game to collect, and you're going to collect enough that the thought of going back is unappealing. Like, if you only came out with like 10 out of the 20, you'd be like, oh, okay, I'll go back and get more of those. But when you come out with like 19 out of 20 consistently, like, oh.
Yeah, I mean, most levels have 30, and, you know, I came out of them first time through with 25 plus pretty across the
board. And you're like, I don't want to do that.
So, yeah, to get the, you know, and most of the unlockables that you get through the cypher coins, you know, you're going to get those really easily, but then there's this huge gap then between getting them all. So I'm assuming it is basically some sort of god mode thing.
Well,
I don't know that for sure.
I assume you burned the 50 to get the catapult working as well.
Yeah.
Like there's one other time where they're used, and it's so, like, the actual event is so stupid, and you feel like an idiot for having done it, but it has payoff. But at the same time, like, the whole game is that way. Like, there's this constant feeling of, oh, I'm an idiot. Because, like we're talking about the armors, like, I always had to wear the stupid collect the money when you're charging up thing, because I was constantly losing my money, because it is kind of a roguelike. Because the knockback is so intense, like, you just get knocked in the pits all the time.
And some of the Plague Knight's powers are cool, though, you know, in terms of wish fulfillment. Like, you can take a potion that nullifies knockback.
Yes.
A certain length of time, which is great. It's like,
yeah.
So, and he can leech health off enemies when he's doing damage. I mean,
abuse the hell out of that.
It's so much stuff he could do, and it's so kind of, you'd struggle to try it all out under all these different circumstances. The one thing I would say where I feel like the game doesn't feel especially well adapted to his incredibly versatile skill set anymore is the bosses.
I was about to say the same thing.
They just don't stand that much of a chance against him, because, you know, they are, you know, so much more designed around the very particular, you know, mobility and attack potential of Shovel Knight. You know, the way that he could get up in the air and attack from above, and, you know, attack from the, you know, like you said, you could lob the bombs, you could throw them straight down, you can make them homing bombs. I mean, just stuff that, you know, it kind of, you know, you'd almost have to be sort of willfully, omit certain options, you know, take certain options away from yourself to make the bosses challenge a lot. So if you just stop for a moment and think, what's the best thing I've got in my arsenal to beat this guy? You're going to beat it pretty quickly.
Yeah, like, I think I only really had any issue with the final boss. And even then...
And that's new. Yeah, that should be designed around his capability, and indeed designed around, you know, him having virtually all his abilities at that point, because most people are going to have bought them by that stage of the game.
I would say that the funniest thing about the boss battles, and with the exception of Tinker Knight in its gigantic form, is that because I was using the hover one so much, I spent most of the battle out of reach, which is consistent with when you fight Plague Knight initially in the game. What he does, he spends a lot of the fight.
He's just throwing stuff from above, you know, creating. I mean, the other thing you could do as well that's quite a key thing you get from Chester is creating your own platforms in midair.
Yes.
Because that mitigates that what I was talking about where it's like, oh, I'm powerful, I'm flying through the air, I've hit something, I've been knocked back a mile, crap, I'm dying. Now, you can, if you've got that is your kind of a sub-weapon ability, which you can cycle through on the shoulder button, so you don't have to pause to kind of change that. But yeah, that was always my default option. Because, you know, if you find yourself getting knocked back, generate one of those platforms as quickly as possible. At least give yourself a chance to survive.
I was using the leech life one most of the time, and especially during the boss battle.
During the boss, because they've got so much health. Leech life it might not be that productive when, you know, you're killing enemies that die pretty quickly. But of course, bosses have so much health to drain.
Them.
Yeah, yeah. And it's another reason why they're pretty much no brainers really.
Yeah, so I mean, if you own Shovel Knight, obviously you should go back and play this, because this is really good, and I really enjoyed it. And if this had been its own game, I would have enjoyed playing it. You certainly would have felt that this wasn't the original concept, but it stands up. Of course, like I said, Shovel Knight was one of my favorite games of last year. So, you know, the fact that they added on essentially an entire new campaign, they also added on, was it the challenge mode?
Yeah, yeah.
Which is just impassable. Like, that stuff is...
I had a little look at that, and it's like, oh, wow.
Yeah, what they want of you is absurd. But one of my favorites is simply, defeat the endless stream of enemies, and you've got one health. I'm like, wait, what? Defeat the endless stream of enemies, and I've got one health. Fuck this, nope. Quit. I was like, I'm not having this nonsense.
Well, I guess the one thing you could say about that, the Plague Knight challenges, I mean, they are very much built specifically around Plague Knight. So at least there is some content there that isn't just kind of a little bit sort of incompatible.
And they control what power-ups you have, too.
Yeah, like which takes away that kind of versatility. I mean, the versatility is a lot of the fun. But it also kind of lessens the specificity of it, in the main game. But with the challenge mode, you get a bit of that. So it's kind of a nice, in theory, counterbalance to the main game in that way. But I haven't actually got into that mode much yet because it looks really scary.
It is very daunting.
Yeah.
But I'm glad they got around to releasing this. This was a big thing for me, and I was super happy to see that it came out, and I had a really good time with it. When they announced this new Plague Knight, I thought, I don't know about this. But I think it was a good call by the voting community. I hope the other two are still on from the Kickstarter, because I'm very curious to see how they would make a fully functioning Propeller Knight stage. Or even go to an additional extreme, how you would play Tinker Knight in a regular gameplay scenario, since his basic job is big damn mech.
Well, presumably it'd be like, I don't know, kind of like Henry Hatsworth or something. You know, you had to sort of building up some meter, and then the giant mech comes out. Or I don't know.
Because his base form is he just runs around on the ground and falls over a lot.
It doesn't do very much, yeah.
Yeah.
How could you not want to be Spectre Knight? How could you not want to be the Grim Reaper? That would be the fun.
Yeah, I mean, again, he kind of flies around, so...
Yeah, how would you adapt that? That's the problem.
He doesn't have feet. Propeller Knight, there's a very obvious way of adapting it, but like they even said in the Kickstarter, if it's him, he's not going to have much health, so just an FYI. It's a really cool add-on to an already really great game, and I really enjoyed it. So, Greg, John, making Marios, are we?
Well, actually... You know, if you felt the earth tremble about 2 weeks ago, gentlemen, I bought an amiibo.
Thanks for listening this week. We will be back next week.
I bought the 8-bit Mario amiibo.
Just hug your children, ladies and gentlemen.
On a whim. On a whim. You know, see, that's the thing. See, I have, every man has his limits. And mine is 8-bit nostalgia trips.
Crunchy pixels.
Crunchy pixels. So,
God, that could be a cuboid cereal, couldn't it? Crunchy pixels. That's a really good idea.
It is. Hmm. Yeah. So I went with the old school Mario, not the new school one. The one with
with the bad colors.
Yeah, with the,
that seems a bit pointless. Like, if you could have the pixel, you would want the way it was, not like this. I guess it's just another one to have. I guess if you're someone that buys a lot of these things, it gives you a second one to buy. But if you were going to have one.
Yeah, but so this guy, I haven't tried to use him as an amiibo. He's just sitting up on a shelf, so.
Oh, so you're just telling us just so we knew.
Yeah, just so you knew. Just, you know, just a, kind of, just as kind of a heads up. You know, just
if you see pigs in the air,
for the record, in Mario Maker, you know, he puts that sort of CRT filter on the level, and the enemies all kind of change.
It is pretty cool.
To be a sort of Mario disguise. Some of the enemies are really funny, like K-Mech Mario is hilarious.
Oh, nice.
He looks really funny. Like, Lakitu is Luigi throwing crap at you from the crowd. and Bowser has Peach riding on his back for some reason. It is trippy. It is really trippy if you actually see, like, a whole bunch of enemies with that filter put over it from the classic amiibo. It's nice.
Now I had read a while back that you can't actually, because I want to keep this guy in the box because it's just my way. Does the NFC actually pick it up through the package?
I think they've got something to block the signal.
Oh, of course they would, right? Because
try it, yeah. Try it, John.
Well, of course they would. Because
if you had like a new 3DS and you just took it to the store and just went onto the box,
exactly.
And the fact that it's on 3DS really doesn't make it very tenable for that to work that way.
Yeah.
But I mean, at worst case scenario, John, you're tapping a box to the gamepad, nothing happens.
Mm-hmm. That aside, yes, I did pick up Super Mario Maker. John,
I gotta say, I'm a little disappointed in your level selection.
I haven't really been around to make any of them.
By your level selection, I meant singular.
Yeah, I mean, I got one, but people seem to enjoy it though. It was short but sweet, and I think it mixes a little bit of skill based stuff with the joy of stuff being just out of your reach, and maybe you can get it, maybe you can't, and you got to try, and then you finally get that one up that has no purpose whatsoever, and then you just feel that, you know, that good feeling, satisfaction kind of thing. I think I'm just saying there's a lot packed into that one level. It's dense.
I can remember enjoying it, but it was like one of the first levels I played, and I can't remember my stats there. It's definitely over 500. So
jeez,
everything's kind of blended together now. Can't remember what's what.
Yep. But yeah, I mean, I haven't. I mean, I would imagine by now. I would assume the entirety of the editor is unlocked for me. I didn't bother going through the exercise of, you know, laying down hundreds of one particular type of whatever and, you know,
you've still
got
to play for a certain length of time per day, you know, John.
Oh, yeah. Really? You still have to? So it doesn't just unlock? It doesn't just trump?
No. Because their objective was to make you learn stuff.
To do it, great. Like, play a little bit with just this part of the set. Now play a bit with this set, having expanded a bit more, and then again and again and again until you reach the full tool set.
See, just the fact that you had to explain that to me shows that it's just too complicated.
Like, it explains it to you in the game!
Just give me the freaking set already.
I was alright with it, it generally playing the game is advisable.
Thanks. It helps. Thanks, Greg. I'll write that one down over here.
Words to live by.
Yeah. Pro tip.
For some reason, I could have imagined Guillaume saying that. I said it for him.
But yeah. So I mean, it's impressive. I mean, it's something you can definitely sink hours and hours into, and really, it gets you thinking outside the game. Sort of, you know, kind of like what it's an interesting trip into game design, really, and kind of it shows you the kind of work that goes into actually having to properly design a long level, like, especially when you try to, because the first one I made is obviously very short, but I do have one in the works that I kind of wasn't happy with, but I'm trying to make it the entire length that you can make it. And it's kind of dickish, So yeah, it's what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to make a level that's here's a little bit of a spoiler alert because for the zero people that are anticipating this level, but I'm trying to make it so you can kind of you climb up to the top, like you go as high up as you can go, and then you have to drop down and kind of guess where the single block that you have to jump on is.
Of course, son of a bitch.
It's pretty much all.
You son of a bitch, John.
It's all or nothing. So, but yeah, you pretty much have to do that all the way through. But man, there are some dick-ish levels out there.
Think you should be more bold, John. Like, have a trail of coins that leads down to the only part of the level that isn't solid ground. that's what I'm expecting from you.
I know. People are expecting really, really trollish stuff, but you know what? I mean, I don't know if my black heart has maybe, unfrozen a little bit.
You just haven't caught it yet.
I don't know. I just don't, or maybe I just haven't effectively learned how to troll in this game when I'm creating stuff, but,
I think it's easier for it to be the other way around. I mean, like, one of the levels I made was not intended as a troll level at all. It was intended to be difficult, but
yeah. Which one?
It's meant to be reasonable, like trial and error kind of stuff. Sure, there's going to be some of that, but, once you kind of got through to a point where you knew what you were doing, it would be fairly dependable. It wouldn't just be like, oh God, there's this thing that's really hard. I'm probably only going to pull off 10% of the time and then another five things like that after that. So, okay, once you've got a technique down for doing that bit.
This isn't the one where you have to carry all the crap around on the coins that have been converted by the P-Switch.
That's a different level.
No, because that level, fuck that level.
That's a puzzle level rather than a challenger level. That's the idea of that one. But anyway, a lot of the feedback of that was just like, oh, this is like the trolliest thing ever. Brutal, all that kind of stuff. It's just, clearly I misjudged that one. And yeah, so, maybe you could just become a troll without even trying is what I'm saying.
Well,
don't have troll anxiety. It'll just come out naturally.
I mean, sometimes the best inspiration I come up with is I just crap something out. Like, I'll spend an hour playing with the level and tinkering on something. And then I'll just say, well, I'm not ready for this one. And then I'll go create Dogs versus Cats, which is just you, the clown car, and as many flying giant bloopers as it would let me put on the screen. And then when you get to the end of this giant pit, it's simply the phrase "Stay Fresh" written in coins around the icon. So like you don't realize until the whole way at the end that it's just one giant Splatfest reference. And then you get to the end, it's a stupid level, but after I made it and put it out there, I was able to kind of go back and sort of clean out the gears and get back to the one I was working on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I mean, I would say don't aim to make troll levels right away. Like make one or two. I have one that I haven't posted yet where it's called like a Bowser Bouncy Castle.
Mm-hmm.
And basically there's like 10, there's just as many doors and pipes as you could. And all but one of them make you end up in essentially like a bunch of the bounce squares, like a prison of bounce squares.
The musical notes.
Yeah. Surrounded by Bowser. So he's in there bouncing alongside you.
So whether or not you actually get out is pretty much luck?
No, you don't get out.
So how do you actually
get it? You know that door is death, so the next time you come back, you're not going to pick that one.
Right.
You're going to pick one of the other six doors that leads to a different kind of instant death.
No, it's the same one I copy-pasted.
Oh, okay, well, that's... Come on. Give us a little something, James, to work
My
with.
My favorite part is the doors are stacked, so... There's only one block missing, and the door essentially drops you down it,
mm-hmm.
So you can't just go right back in the door. And then if you go through the next door, you realize that door is right on top of the one you went through last time, and you just drop right back down into it anyway.
That's really trolly.
Like just the idea of it just constantly doing that. And I didn't post it because like you can beat it in 5 seconds if you know the way out.
Yeah.
But like it's just like, all right, this is a bit much. This is a bit brash.
Yeah.
But alternatively, you could do stuff like have Bowser chase them. Mm-hmm. And like, that's not really trolling, but it's funny and it causes people to panic because Bowser will chase you.
Yeah.
Normally they control that in game because Bowser only has areas that he is enclosed in. But if you don't enclose him in an area, he will, and you get past him, he will pursue. And he could pursue.
Yeah,
really
I played
well.
A level based on that by, PokePal, his handle in the forums. Yeah, he did kind of an auto-scrolling level. With Bowser's, where they chase you. So it almost is like kind of recreation of the very final battle in New Super Mario Bros. Wii with a giant Bowser kind of, obviously, you know, you can't do like that big a Bowser, even however big you make him, but that was cool. I like that.
So then put another Bowser at the other end when they've now got Bowsers pursuing them. That's trolling level, John.
It's like, trolling level. I
don't want to emphasize too much the trolling stuff, because, you know, like there's a lot if you go on the featured section.
Oh yeah,
there's a lot of auto playing stuff. There's a lot of musical recreations are getting popular now. Mm-hmm. You know, and then you might have a few dickish levels, but you know, you can find some good levels to play.
Absolutely,
No doubt about it. I mean, just within our community beyond ourselves, TYP's levels have been really good. We put his Miiverse ID in the show notes for the article for the last episode. Mm-hmm. And Nick Bray's got some good stuff. His Miiverse ID.
I need to go try that.
Traveller 7, and it's Traveller spelt with two L's because it's the, you know, more UK way. As he's in the
as he is a UK prisoner. Yes.
No. So if I guess the quickest way you could get to levels without doing the whole code thing is, if you go to, on your Miiverse thing, go to activity feed, search user, put in their Miiverse ID, then just scroll through their posts and find the code, rather than us, like, reading out a code, a 16-character code.
But you can't do anything once you're there, right?
No, you still have to write it down and then put it in.
Yeah. Right.
It would be nice if it was, like, a clickable link or something, you know, even
That's what I thought it was, and then I realized, no, it's not.
No, it isn't, no. I mean, you'd still have to, but rather than, like, you know, it's really unwieldy for us to read out a bunch of 16-digit codes.
0000.
Yeah, lots of zeros.
0073.
That was disappointing, but I mean, I just go in and I find the person. I get one code, find the person, and then follow them.
That's John's relationship advice. And I mean, find your code, then follow.
There's plenty more WR staffers beyond.
Also, read the mail. Always read the mail.
Beyond TYP and Nick. Beyond TYP and Nick, there's plenty more NWR staffers that have got cool levels.
We got a feature out.
There's an article posted that has codes and IDs to follow and everything. Beyond that, though, a couple of other media people that are good. If you look for Pear IGN, which is PER-IGN, Pear Schneider, you know, ran N64.com all those years ago.
He's been around forever.
Yeah, and now he runs IGN these days. He's got some really cool levels, uses the different sort of palettes and stuff to create like locales that you wouldn't necessarily think of, like use the airship theme that they made for the 8-bit Mario to make it look like you're going up a high-rise building, which is quite fun.
That's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. And you know, use the airship theme also to, I think, for Super Mario 3 to do like a train kind of style of level and stuff. So yeah, I mean, he's done some really cool stuff. You know, hits a nice balance between sort of creativity visually and in the layout, and you know, challenge without it being, you know, particularly punitive or anything. And then Jeremy Parrish, who's at jeremy.parrish, I think is his Miiverse ID, if you want to put that in. But he's basically like stopped because of TGS. You know, he had to go cover it. So just when he was sort of getting rolling. But I know he was bigger on the media server part of it and doing the YouTube videos and stuff. So I assume he will like start putting more up at some point. And the ones he's put up so far are good. And I anticipate, you know, any further ones should be worth playing as well. So yeah, there's that way you could do it. But also, you know, there's a number of other ways to discover levels that might be good.
Going in 100 Mario mode is funny because you get to see kind of like the trends of the styles of levels people make. Like, I find people love to fool you with like blind drops or pointing you to places that you can't see, but you just have to blindly jump into the air.
You're welcome.
People love doing that all over the place, and they love the springs that you jump on. They love those. I mean,
springs are one of the first things you get.
Yeah, so they're everywhere. Like,
there's a hell of a lot of levels. Especially, I mean, when I downloaded it at midnight, like, my level was based around springs. Everybody's levels was based around springs, apart from the really small subset of people that just spent 3 hours spamming tiles to unlock everything at once. But, I mean, that's the thing, though. If you find someone, you know, it just played 100 Marios, and I've done this, I've played the expert, I've cleared expert about 5 times, I've done the other ones a number of times as well, so I've played, like I said, hundreds of levels at this point, and, you know, some of them are fun, some of them aren't. But every now and again, you hit someone something that just, like, not only is it fun, but it's like, yeah, you know, this person has something about them that, you know, the kind of level design ethos or paradigm that fits with what I'm looking for. So, yeah. You know, after you come out of the 100 Mario mode, go and look up the level in your play history. Then you can follow them, look at all the other levels they've made, and you might find quite a few more that you really like. And then the other thing is you could look at what levels they've played, which ones they've starred, for instance. And then that may, you know, if you are indeed like-minded, you know, that'll lead you to more people that you get on with their kinds of levels. And also, you know, God forbid, if you make something that other people get and star, then you could look at what they've played and what they've made, and that might again lead you to other stuff. So it's not as direct as you'd like, but it can be done.
It's a Mario Maker dating service.
No need to be worried about just, oh, all I'm ever going to get is auto-scrolling the horrible stages.
I mean, I've read some articles about that, and I read the one review that was just talking about, like, pretty much it was just kind of bashing the game about how it was so trolly. And how it, you know, how it went against the whole ethos of the Mario franchise, because it, instead of having these wonderfully crafted, you know, creations, it just lets people, you know, let their troll, you know, get unleashed in full force. I was like, I don't really see that at all. I mean, yeah, there's some stuff, but I mean, you can just skip it. Like,
yeah, I mean, there's no penalty whatsoever.
Do you probably have to make more of an effort to avoid it than would be ideal? Yeah, but I mean, when you've got a million levels, however many it's going to be up to how many more it's going to be up to by the time people hear this, you know, I mean, that's going to happen. That's life, you know, that's just, you know, the fact is, if you just make some kind of effort, like what I'm talking about, and it'd be nice if it was less effort, but it is what it is. I've found plenty of levels I've enjoyed.
Oh, yeah.
Very many. And, you know, you get a lot of fun out of playing ones that feel like a sort of convincing Mario level. But also you get ones that would never be in a mainline game. For various reasons, you know, many of them perfectly understandable, but it's still fun to play them, you know, and feel like, yeah, I'm getting something a bit different. I mean, obviously, you know, that sword, you know, cuts both ways, because you'll get a lot of stuff that would never be in a Mario game because it ain't fun. But overall, I like this sort of, you know, just being able to kind of liberate the Mario experience in the way that this game does.
Yeah,
and I will say that with
10 and 100 Mario 2, just to kind of finish that up, is that it gives you a mix in that sometimes, you know, you never really know what you're going to get. It's like, you know, like Mario chat roulette or something where, you know, you just sometimes you get something that is.
I don't need to see that.
Sometimes you get something that's so easy.
Mario chat roulette.
To continue
roulette.
Along with the chat roulette analogy, sometimes you get something that's so easy, whatever. And sometimes you get something that's so hard, but you never know what you're going to get.
Well, I mean, yes, it's like the.
Should be shamed yourself.
I heard that sigh. Whoever sighed.
It was Guillaume. But they're very rightfully so as well.
I will say that one thing that I've been curious about is how the featured works.
Oh yeah, that is weird. I've been trying to. Actually saw TYP's one of TYP level featured on there once. For people that say it's universally bad, that is now demonstrably false.
So, like, I had one that was some random person in Norway's level, and I was only the second person to play it from the looks of it, and it was just dicks. The whole stage.
You knew it had to happen, but
it was you traveling through and out the top of dicks. And, like, I was like, why is this the featured stage? What is happening right now?
Obviously, no human vetted it.
I was like, only 2 people have ever played this stage. What?
How could it get featured from that little, like, that little data? Yeah, I mean, it is really weird. Whereas, like, TYP stage that I saw in the feature, I don't think was that new unless he just redone it, you know, because when you tweak something and like re-upload it, you know, it's effectively a new level.
Right.
But yeah, I'm not really, isn't that for the up and coming bit anyway? Like the new levels?
Maybe, like, but like straight, it was like the second one under featured and it was basically called like there was no ambiguity about what that stage was from its name. And I'm like, oh no. And I went in and I'm like, oh.
Well, yeah, so now well, you give me the idea, I'll have to make one for Dicta Chat.
You really needed that idea to be given to you, John.
You know, Greg, I'm mature.
What do you take of
you haven't been on the podcast for a while.
You're just trying to pass off the responsibility to someone else. You own your dick idea, John.
You haven't been on the podcast for a while. I've matured. I don't think like that anymore.
You expect me to believe
that. You've
gotten
old. You haven't matured.
All right? Man.
See, now I'm torn between Mario Chat Roulette and Own Your Dicto Chat, John. I don't know what the episode title to go with.
Yep. Oh, I'm writing all this down, buddy. I'm taking notes this time.
Anyway, that's going to have to do it for new business this week.
All right, I'm done. Mario Maker. It's awesome. Check
Jesus.
It out.
Johnny actually made a level. Johnny's got some interesting levels.
Yeah, he's made several.
We did a video, he and I. So if you really miss hearing the doctor, you can hear him design a stage about using the cape. And then realize that I never actually used the cape and I beat Super Mario World without using it. And I don't know how to use the cape. So that went really poorly. But it's a cool level. He's got a few cool levels you can try him out. If you want, you can go watch that. We'll pimp more stuff in the next segment right after this break. Now playing, a sampling of the best new original content at NintendoWorldReport.com. First up this week, we have a review. Animal Crossing Happy Home Design on 3DS by Brian Rose. If RFN guest Seren McNulty's ringing endorsement of this title a few weeks ago wasn't enough to make you rush out and ignore it, Brian stops by with his review to pile on the truth bombs. He did find some good news, so find out what that is in his review.
AKA Happy House Arrest.
Happy House Arrest. Use the Force Edition as you move furniture around. Mm-hmm. We've got a lot of names for this game. Too bad it doesn't have a lot of gameplay in it.
Yep.
We also have a review, Extreme Exorcism on Wii U by Neuronan. No longer content to be what Guillaume does in his spare time, Extreme Exorcism is now a Wii U game that has you battling ghosts that use your own powers against you. Rumor has it that Poutine DLC is on the way, so check out Neil's review in preparation for fries, gravy, and cheese curds.
It makes me hungry.
Is that how Guillaume edits the show? Just ghosts?
I think so, ghosts, and I think he's fueled by poutine.
I think this episode probably needs an exorcism.
I don't even know where this is going. Probably not my best work, but
bad
anyways.
Place.
We have a feature. The RFN Super Mario Maker Challenge. New Capes on the Block is the level name.
Yep.
This is with James and Johnny. Johnny Metz makes a Super Mario Maker stage. He makes a triumphant return, comes out of retirement for a moment. And James plays through it. What could go wrong? Plenty. Apparently, James is really terrible with, you'll just have to watch the video to find out. Phasers set to judge.
To be fair, I judge me in that video pretty harshly. Also, yeah. there's a huge amount of fast-forwarding going on, so you don't know how long I actually played it.
Yeah, it was pretty painful, I'll be honest with you, James.
It hurts me.
It's just, you know, it's just like you had to do one thing. Just one thing.
Well, he happened to find the one thing I can't do. It's not my fault.
All right, we have a feature also, Remembering Super Mario Bros. 3 by Justin Berube, Brian Rose, and Donald Terrio. Ah, Super Mario 3. Possibly my most cherished game. One that I come back to time and again for a breezy, smile-inducing, relaxing playthrough. Justin, Brian, and Donald share their thoughts on what has made the game as equally cherished in their own lives, particularly when playing with the excellent 3DS D-pad. I made that part up.
You can find this and more three-way discussion about D-pads right now at NintendoWorldReport.com.
I'm not saying a damn thing.
Fine.
Three-way D-pads, people.
And we're back. It's time for your listener mail. We haven't done a proper listener mail segment in a couple weeks, so we've got lots to get through, but you can send us your email, because we always want more. We always want more email. To rfn@attenderworldreport.com. I will plug that again at the end, and you'll get two reads that time. But first up, the first email is Guy.
Sure. Void writes, "Hey guys, long-time listener, first time writing in. You probably know me from Twitter as Void. @grnmushroom.
Since I chat with you guys, we're not turning into the Twitter plug segment.
Well, you know. My question is about games for my daughter. She's five years old now, but I've been gaming with her for as long as she could hold a controller. She's already beaten a ton of games on her own, like Kirby Triple Deluxe, New Super Mario Bros. 2, Mario Party Island Tour. Mario Party 10, Mario Kart 7 and 8. And she's super proficient at other games like Luigi's Mansion, Dark Moon, Super Mario Maker, Pikmin 3, Mario 64, and a ton of iPad games. She's been around gaming her whole life, and her favorite games are Nintendo. For reference, she has her own 2DS, I have a 3DS XL, and we have a Wii U as a family. And she's been around PlayStation, Microsoft, PC, iOS, for her whole life since I have all the other consoles. I'm looking for new games for her. Problem I'm running into is that next set of games I know she would love all need reading comprehension that she doesn't have yet. I'm super excited to introduce her to Pokemon and Animal Crossing New Leaf, but I've hesitated to pull the trigger because of the reading skills needed. Can you recommend any more games for my five-year-old? Keep in mind she's super proficient at gameplay mechanics, but doesn't have a ton of reading skills yet."
You know, I think you could get through to a certain extent Animal Crossing with fairly limited reading, because I mean, essentially you have things, you give it to people, they get excited.
Right.
It's not the hardest thing to get, like, a lot, because they pantomime a lot of what they're doing as well. So it helps quite a bit. And
yeah, but I think a lot of the entertainment of Animal Crossing is the dumb stuff that your villagers are saying. So I think that I'm not sure if she would get a lot out of it, except, you know, having a few animals that look funny.
It's not Scribble Knots, let's put it that way. Like, right. You can get by. It's just, it might be a little bit trickier.
Yeah, it might actually get boring for her after a while.
Yeah, that's what I think. I think, you know, like, as far as Pokemon goes, there's a lot of side games, and they're not all garbage, and they don't all need reading comprehension. I mean, we've talked about Pokemon Pinball recently, and I haven't played it yet, but like on the Wii U VC, you've got Pokemon Snap, that's supposed to be pretty good.
Pokemon Rumble? Like that, yeah. That game requires essentially no reading.
Yeah.
It may require no thinking, but that's a different issue.
I'm not a father. I suppose none of us here are. So I don't feel very well. It's a curious thing to be asking.
I'm a pastor,
about
that
this.
Was in past but, life.
Great.
But, you know, I can go back to the games that I played as a 5-year-old that didn't require much reading. So Punch-Out, Castlevania, Cobra Triangle. I think all of these would be excellent choices. It's on Rare Replay. It's accessible now.
That's what I was going to say. I was just saying that to Guillaume.
You're not wrong.
There's probably some on Rare Replay. I was wondering, maybe Blast Corps? Maybe? I mean, its mechanic is pretty simple. You just smash
Do you
stuff.
Think the idea of nuclear Armageddon is too much for a 5-year-old job?
Hey, I mean, you know...
No pressure, kid, but if you don't destroy everything with this dump truck correctly, we're all dead. You know the bit in T2 that I haven't shown you yet where the kids are all on fire? It's going to be like that.
She has to be introduced to it eventually. You know, this is what's called the nuclear Holocaust.
No, she doesn't. It's not the Cold War anymore, Joe. We don't teach to fucking get under the desk.
Have you met Vladimir Putin?
This is your bunker. If you see a flash of light in the sky, get under the table. Just these are simple things.
You'll be fine.
To a certain extent, I get what he's saying, though, because there's a lot of these games where I think, oh, yeah, that's a, not necessarily a simple game, but a game where the fun is worn very much on its sleeve, but there is a lot of, you know, text to go with it.
Yeah, I mean, that's what, I mean, in seriousness, older games might be an idea, because you know they had to work around the limitations. They wouldn't have that much text in a lot,
right? They didn't care essentially.
Yeah, you know, they were arcade style games, and you know they wouldn't have to be the ridiculously hard games that a lot of us played. You know, there could be ones that were easier back then. You know, like
Ninja Gaiden 3.
Yeah, not that. You know, like a Kirby's Adventure or something like that.
What about the Canvas Curse for Wii U?
Yeah, that's. Yeah, I mean, look, it's not out in America yet. I'm assuming. You know, that's the market that we're dealing with here. But I mean, Yoshi's Woolly World.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't see how that wouldn't be a joy for anyone, any person at all, but certainly a small child.
Baby games.
You're not a man, John. You're just black hatred in this vague human shape.
Oh,
black hatred in vague human shape. I love it.
We're just stacking on level titles this week, episode titles rather. I mean, the problem is that, and we say this because you know we've gone through the whole review process of these games. That's that there's a very poor understanding of how to make games that are both accessible and enjoyable. And if you were to try to buy games that are marketed at your daughter, there is not all of them, but there is going to be a large number of them that just seem to have adopted the policy of, I mean, whatever, they're kids, they don't care.
Yep.
Well, now, though, actually, those games don't really exist except in the touch environment. Like, they haven't made those games on the handhelds anymore.
Yeah, it's very different. I mean, if you think about the kind of stuff that flooded the shelves for GBA.
Or even DS.
And DS. To a large, and then look at that with 3DS now. Yeah, that exodus is very apparent.
Yeah, so and like a lot of those games are in the touch space where they can make them for even less money, and they can be somehow even worse.
Yeah, they can monetize.
That's Yay! Right, and they can make more money out of a worse game.
Yeah.
I mean, we talked about earlier if you could find it, things like Super Princess Peach, which is you know I think it's kind of a funny game. There's people who have issues with it, but you know it is what it is. As it's enjoyable for being what a game it is. I mean, really, we talked about a lot of Kirby games. Kirby 64 is I really enjoy that game. I think it's got some neat mechanical stuff.
Having just played it, I would go along with that. I think you know there is a real sort of element of just play involved with those combining those powers that would presumably appeal to children.
Let's see what. Really, I mean, did he mention Smash Brothers?
Too violent, no. Surely. It's just it's T-rated for a reason, James.
I have yet to figure that reason out, to be honest. But like, I think kids, because it's very reminiscent of, you know, the cartoon violence that kids see in TV shows. I think.
Doesn't mean they should see it, though, does it? Doesn't mean they should.
Well, how about some puzzle games, maybe? Like, get her to try Tetris or Paneled Upon, like The Pokemon version is on the Wii Virtual Console, maybe one day on Wii U. So that's colorful. That would be an introduction to Pokemon, and it's a fun game. It's one of my favorite puzzle
games.
And
it kind of fits what you're looking for in terms of it's intuitive. It doesn't need a lot of instructional stuff. I mean, it's surprising to me sometimes when stuff that's aimed at kids, obviously older kids than 5 years old, but how sort of reading heavy it is. So you know, in terms of not so much that they would have difficulty comprehending it, but just that they think that they would find it fun. I mean, many years ago, I reviewed the second, I think it was this, yeah, what's the second? The second Pokemon Ranger game. It's enormously talky.
Oh yeah, it
reams and reams of dialogue at the start about you're at the Ranger Academy and you got to talk to all these people and you know sort of earning your stripes in the Ranger system or whatever, and I just you know, kids got the attention span for this, you know, like quote unquote kid friendly games are not always as kid friendly as they think they are. I think intuitive games is the biggest thing that you want for a child of this age, and so something like a Tetris, I think, is you know they will
right.
You know, I mean, it might take them a while, but if they just play it, I have confidence that they will begin to understand it, and you know that'll be part of the fun.
Mm-hmm. I mean, something like Parodius, which is
that was the internet before the internet, because it was all about cats and scantily clad girls.
No, sorry. Well, I mean, to an extent, yes. But like, there, it's not the hardest shooter in the world. There's another one though that's not that not as much scantily clad. I'm just blanking on what it's called.
Yeah, that kind of creeped in there more and more as it went on. I don't think there's that much of the scantily clad girls in the MSX one that started it all.
Okay.
But after that, it's you're pretty quickly.
It slides downhill.
It's perfectly absurd, but I would not recommend it for a 5-year-old.
I mean, whatever. It's, you know.
It's a Vegas showgirl doing the Exorcist spider walk as a goof on a Gradius battle. A five year old is not going to get that on any of those levels, nor
you
should.
You know what your child is ready for.
Muscle march.
Yes, indeed.
I mean, State of Punishment Star Successor. The story can't make any less sense to them.
I know exactly.
Yeah. I mean, but there is stuff from TG16 era that is weirdly child approachable, especially visually. A lot of the stuff on that system was very colorful and cartoony looking, like stuff like Bonk.
Yeah, Bonk's Adventure. Like, yep.
That's a very approachable game.
Yeah, the new Adventure Island is it's a cartoon. It's wonderful. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I played Bonk at about 5 years old, so I can vouch for a 5-year-old playing that game. I played the shit out of that game, and I played the Game Boy version. That was terrible.
I had that too.
I still play it into the ground.
Ah, Master Higgins. Good guy.
I mean, there's some, I think the Virtual Console is kind of a weirdly fertile ground for some of this stuff, because there was
it's a nice portal back in time to a place where games like made it their business to not have to be explained to be fun,
right?
Like that. Yeah. That's, I think it's still something that Nintendo can be very good at, but not exclusively anymore. You know, sometimes the games are very wordy.
Yes.
Right, and back then also games were more aimed at kids than today. Yeah.
Well, and the forms had
but also ridiculously hard.
Yeah, sorry.
Which, I mean, look, I have no. I mean, he speaks about the proficiency of his daughter. That, you know, maybe if you threw her in at the deep end, she'd swim just fine. You know, I mean, that's what happened to me. The first game I ever played was Punch Out. That just put me on the path of playing ridiculously hard games for the rest of my life.
So scantily clad women, whatever. But punching ethnic stereotypes in the face. Okay, fine.
That was fine. Look, to be fair, you're forgetting one thing though. His daughter lives now. This was back in the 80s. That was perfectly fine back then.
Come here, Guido. I'm going to knock your
teeth out. The Berlin Wall hadn't even come down yet. I mean, the rest of the world was just terrifying.
Wow, it's overtly political, this episode.
You sit in an additional parliament with some of these stereotypes that you just beat the crap out of. I want you to remember that. These were people on the other side of the Iron Curtain.
Yeah, well, it's all different now, James.
It's all different now.
We live in a different world.
Once the channel tunnel was completed, it became
exactly. The channel tunnel wasn't even completed back then, so, you know, we couldn't.
Once that happened, you can't beat the crap out of French people.
We were then confronted with the fact that Glass Joe was not, in fact, representative of every Frenchman who's ever lived.
All right, any other quick fires before we wrap through?
Rhythm Heaven, maybe?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's hard in some places, yep.
But it doesn't explain, it doesn't have to explain
no,
itself
cause
very much.
I mean, WarioWare is the same way, it's just like...
Yeah, I think WarioWare might be even better.
Because you get, even if you can't figure it out, it's over in 10 seconds, so
right.
Try again.
The Wii version, I think, is probably the best to get started on. It's just, like, the motions are simple, and the game is so funny, and also I think the game reads out loud to you what you're supposed to do.
It probably does. And additionally, you could play it with her, because there's multiplayer modes.
Right.
So, yeah, that's a good one. I mean, there's probably some stuff on Wii that we're not thinking of.
Maybe it's one of the Star Foxes? Like, those are pretty simple games.
Yeah,
there's a lot of reading, kind of, but it's...
I mean, in 64, they read to you.
Yeah, I mean, it has nothing to really
do with anything. You've got the speech there.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of options. I think a lot of classic stuff does really well for this stuff. So, yeah, I mean... Let us know what you ended up picking out. Like, I'd be really curious what games she took to. Because that way our other readers or listeners who are in a similar position may find that informative.
Yeah.
But in general, there's better people to get parental advice from.
I've got a few nephews and nieces around, but they all suck at games, so...
Yeah, they're minor...
I really can't make recommendations based on them. They just they keep complaining and lose.
They just get mad.
The
Bayat's
known for their terrible video game skills.
Like I bought each and every one of them Ogre Battle 64. I don't think any of them have beaten it yet. I mean, they're 8 and 6. Come on, get on top of it. So I got the next email. James, not me. Other James. Just to clear that up, because now that is totally in play, writes, let's go ahead and do some navel gazing. Audience members who don't like it left long ago. True. I just heard that Kimishima is to be Iwata's successor. I seem to recall he was a bit of a cipher in his position at Nintendo of America before Reggie took things over. Do you think this is an indication that the executive side of the company is ceding power to the board, or do you think that Kimishima's NOA experience will lead him to push Nintendo into a more globally focused company? What other implications will this appointment carry? P.S. I've been listening to what I used to call the, quote, the Greg days, but now I have to call, quote, the first Greg days. When I heard Johnny was leaving, I was devastated. I always thought of him as the dad of the show. Greg was the mom. When Greg left, it felt like they got divorced, and that crushed me too. But Guillaume turned out to be a really great stepmom. But imagine my emotional confusion to hear now that dad was leaving too, the stepmom is staying, and you get mom back. My two moms. It oddly balanced the scales so we, the audience children, won't necessarily grow up as damaged as you might imagine. I will miss Johnny every episode, but I'm elated to have Greg back. And, if you're curious, I think James is the argumentative uncle that lives with us because everyone fears he'll hurt himself or others if he lived alone. And John is, of course, the mostly senile grandpa whom we love for his jolly moments of lucidity and uneasily ignore the rest of the time. Great show, guys. Keep it up. Two things.
Thanks.
One, apparently you've left the uncle in charge of the house, so you're welcome.
It's like in the Rocky
Five. Wait, what you mean the moms can't be in charge of the house?
No, it's like in Rocky Five where Paulie just spazzes all the money away. Basically, that's where James is in that position.
Yo, that's not a sexist thing. I am the host of the show. I'm in charge. So, and additionally, I have lived by myself, thank you, for 3 years, and I have not killed anyone yet that I remember.
Give me my diapers. I made it dirty.
Other episode titles, get me my diapers, I made it dirty. Jesus Christ. Kimishima.
Yes.
New CEO of Nintendo.
Yeah.
So.
Take it away, James.
Yeah. Do you want me to go first? You guys want to go first?
I meant to read up on him, and then I didn't. So.
Yeah, I mean, I can't claim to have the most encyclopedic knowledge of Mr. Kimishima's history.
Okay,
I mean,
but you picked this email.
I did. Because we promised we would talk about this last week. So, but I do have information about, you know, who he is, what he's done, you know, what his career arc is. And ultimately, he was the replacement for Minoru Arakawa, who was brought back from Nintendo of America. He has the emailer's point. Yes, he spent significant amount of times in America in his life. You know, he has children who live in America, a family, and he visits them fairly regularly. So yes, he is familiar with the U.S. market, and of course he worked there for quite a number of years. He also was at the Pokemon Company, and he was actually the CFO of the Pokemon Company, and he was involved for a while in Pokemon USA Incorporated, i.e. the U.S. branch of the company. So yes, he does have experience. I don't know that I would consider him to be a cipher in that position. I think, you know, he is the prototypical businessman. I mean, his original, you know, his first job was he was at Sanwa Bank of Japan.
Yeah.
He handled corporate communications. I mean, he was a bank dude, and I mean, he worked around the world, or the Americas specifically, mm-hmm. in that position. You know, when he went to Nintendo, they hired him because of his business acumen, not because of his experience in the video game industry.
Yeah, and I mean, that's kind of a new thing where there's the kind of the thought process where somebody has to be a game guy to run a game company.
Yeah, I mean, that was
it's
obviously
not really the case necessarily.
Obviously, that's not been the history of Nintendo. No. Iwata is actually the exception.
I mean, he is completely.
So, I mean, Yamauchi didn't even play the games when he wanted you to come in and show them off. He made you play them for him.
Yeah, I mean, he looked at them exclusively as a product. There was no.
Yeah, you know, he is ultimately a business guy, and I don't know that there's going to be a tremendous amount observational difference from his appointment as CEO. I mean, it's not like they brought him in as an outsider. He was deep in Nintendo. Now, he was no longer at NOA, but it's not always immediately clear what he was doing all the time at Nintendo. You know, he spent a lot of time just in the corporate leadership structure. So
I think managed HR at some point, although people have kind of referenced that. And of course, when he took over the head of NOA post, he had succeeded Arakaru, who was Yamauchi's son-in-law, right?
Which is true Japanese business.
Yeah, it is. But then, of course, so at first Reggie was kind of promoted and Kimishima was sort of moving upstairs, but more of in a background role. And then, of course, Iwata took that role from him. He became the president. He became the CEO of NOA, didn't he? With Reggie as president. So I'm kind of interested whether did Kimishima essentially get his old job back as part of his new job now?
they're probably still working that out. So he was a managing director.
Because it's kind of interesting that he, there hasn't been that, but there was, with the sort of things that were released, the information that was released about the restructuring, which went way beyond just the Kimishima in the big chair. There was some mention about people at NOE, but nothing about NOA, which I thought was a bit odd.
Well, and NOE was being managed out of Japan.
Yeah, I assume that's mainly the reason, but it's still, I would have felt somewhat germane, like Iwata was the CEO of NOA. And he obviously isn't anymore. So who is doing that job, or does that job still exist? Or I don't think we've had any clarity on that.
I mean, it was one of those situations where Iwata was CEO, but you have to assume that Mr. Fizume and his coterie of people were running the show.
Oh, sure, but I mean, the reason why they made that move, and it may mainly have been as a gesture to the board or people they wanted to appease, but was to say that, we've got more of a sort of joined up approach, that we're more hands on. We know that a lot of our revenue is going to come from outside of Japan, naturally. The markets are way bigger. Looking at, obviously America is the biggest, and then you've got Europe too. But, so we need to make sure we've got our hands around this thing, that this is what our profits are going to rely on. So I think it's a little odd we haven't heard about that yet. And he would seem well suited to do that, to serve in that capacity.
Right.
But it's really, he seems like someone who's got plenty of sort of management and administrative experience that they want to have, steady hand at this particular sort of time. But the other aspects of the restructuring are far more interesting to me. First of all, the fact that he is essentially part of a triumvirate with the creative fellow Miyamoto.
Yes.
And the sort of hardware platform development sort of fellow in Takeda. So you kind of have now hardware czar, software czar. Perhaps in recognition of the fact that Kimishima, though he's been with Nintendo for many years, is not a games guy. Mm-hmm. You have these two people who are essentially there to set the direction for the company in terms of strategy for software and hardware, whereas presumably Iwata could have done that himself because he knew all about those sorts of things. He would be relied upon to have vision in those areas that presumably they feel maybe people wouldn't have confidence in Kimishima.
That would be tremendously uncommon as from an executive chair. Like, his knowledge of technology is unbelievable for somebody in his position.
Yeah.
So it makes sense that he would have a chief deputy over both of those areas, and that they come to him, and essentially the role of the CEO is to give the final approval on the suggestions your subordinates make. I mean, that's that's ultimately what management is to a certain extent. You are putting your name on the line by reviewing what people come to you with the suggestion.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I see Kimishima as being sort of more like what are generally the better NFL owners that just listen to what the people tell them, rather than, your Snyder types.
Thank you.
Or Jerry Jones. Jerry did rebuild the offensive line. But, you've got you know, people like Miyamoto and Takeda that really know their stuff on those two sides, and you know, he's just got to sort of balance everything and make the final calls, but that they're kind of, you know, setting the sense of direction. But of course, with those two people moving into those positions, you then had, you know, a number of others, sort of promotions and restructurings and all that underneath them.
You had teams get merged in together. And
lots of merging of teams, which, I mean, I think it's a direct, and I think that's probably the big theme here, is that obviously Iwata could not be replaced by any one person because he was, as you said, a sort of a one-off in terms of, you know, a relatively young man with all this experience in the industry, but also, you know, having this, the management ability, to run the company while also being this sort of cuddly, face. Forward, front facing, you know, part of it with the directors. That, I mean, I just, yeah, I don't think there was any way that you could pick one person and just, oh, just do what he was doing.
I would say that the craziest thing about that is how little credit I think we gave his predecessor for essentially pulling him out of HAL and making him, putting him in that position. Because it would have been very easy for Yamauchi to just say, all right, it's going to be one of my relatives is CEO, because that's had been every CEO.
It had been a dynastic sort of company up until.
Yeah, I mean, and he owned the company. He could do that. Yeah. But, you know, he very smartly found somebody who had been running HAL, which isn't a big company.
But he'd also been a high-level executive at Nintendo, but I assume some of that was what he
he'd
already been kind of grooming him as well. So I think he was identified, you know, sometime before that. So I think certainly Hiroshi Yamauchi's choice of Iwata has been, despite, you know, it hadn't all been great results from the decisions he's made, but I think it's been vindicated over time, and you know, just it's very difficult to replicate. But I do think what's happening now does represent still a certain level of continuity with the general approach that Iwata had them on, which was about consolidation in many cases. This merging of teams. Yeah, before we had the merging of the development groups that, you know, we're dealing, well, one hand we've got the handheld people, one, and then on the other side we've got the console people. You know, they were merged back when Iwata was still around. Now we've got EAD and SPD merged together. It just feels like it's all about, you know, these barriers that we've got internally that in the end are just kind of costly and not very efficient. Let's close as many as them as we possibly can.
And that's why they existed. I mean, ultimately, they existed because Mr. Yamauchi wanted to have two teams that were essentially competing for his love.
I know, and I mean, if I remember correctly, obviously Gunpei Yokoi had R&D 1, but then wasn't Miyamoto R&D 4?
It was
quite a number of groups, and they've been sort of consolidated over a large number of time. That's only natural. Because game development has become so much more complicated, so much more costly, you know, it just doesn't make sense to have any duplication of those costs where you could avoid it.
And to that point, Nintendo had also built that giant megalith of a building that they have in Kyoto that was for their that was essentially for their development teams. Like this brand new building, all about their development teams and giving them a new place to live and collaborate and work together. So this is just essentially the final, maybe not even the final step, the next step on the plan that they had sort of created expressly towards this objective. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, Kimishima's own comments in the interviews he's talked about, he's an older gentleman. He was picked primarily because he had that management experience. He has experience in various companies and various roles. He knows how a company is run, and he knows Nintendo very cold, and the people of Nintendo know him as well, which is a big deal when you're the new executive. The people in the company know you too, because that way they know how to deal with you. There's not that weird, awkward transition phase where you're learning your new manager. Everybody there knows him.
Yeah.
So they're able to sort of keep going. You know, they don't have to stop and sort of re-get their bearings. He knew Iwata's plans. He was a senior officer in the company prior to Mr. Iwata's passing, so he was certainly involved in the conversations. You know, I don't know how true the story is, where he basically called out the Wii U's fate during executive meetings before it launched.
Yeah, see, I wonder if he'll be a little bit more commonsensical in some things, whereas Iwata, perhaps his background and passion for game design might have kind of... There's been things in the past that Nintendo has done that really didn't make much business
sense.
But see,
he didn't call it out as a design problem. He basically called out that it wasn't clear that it was a new thing. And he was right. Yeah. I think ultimately what you're going to see, though, is because, you know, he speaks, you know, his comments about Iwata were, you know, he very didn't, you know, gush during the interview, but there was certainly a high degree of reverence there in talking about, you know, maintaining this plan he put us on. Because ultimately, Mr. Kimishima would have been involved in that, the discussions that built that plan already.
Yep.
He was in the room when that plan was being honed and articulated and devised. So he is sort of the perfect person to keep it running, because we talked about when Yamauchi pulled Iwata from HAL and made him an executive, and he gained all that experience of how Nintendo runs, and people in Nintendo became more comfortable with him. They didn't have that person in the wings. Like, there's talk that Iwata had his protege, I'm blanking on his name, but that, you know, their person isn't ready. And, you know, the people who are central figures of the company, I would assume, don't want to step into the CEO position. So, I mean, this is one of those situations where he has a responsibility, and he talks about it in the interview, of prepping his successor. And that's probably, you know, executing on the plans they've got, the NX plans, their plans for the consolidation of the teams, their plans for the new licensing agreements they're working on, development of things, of other, you know, economic opportunities that they mentioned.
Yeah.
You know, using the stock buyback that one of the last investor briefings, Mr. Iwata said, you know, we're planning on using all the stock we've bought back for, you know, the magic mergers and acquisitions phrase. Like, his job is to continue that plan.
And, of course, the DNA, partnership stuff. I mean, that's the thing. The timing is important here. I don't think they would have been very happy with someone who was at least in the sort of management game, a neophyte. At this juncture is really tough.
Because he's juggling so much.
Big changes are afoot, and, you know, there's some question about whether, you know, Nintendo's sort of part of the market is even going to exist, you know, for much longer. So what do you have to do? Do you have to create a new niche? Do you have to just get out of it altogether, diversify radically? There's just so many challenges that, you know, you at least want somebody who, you know, that is credible in the role. And then, you know, hopefully, you know, could just take the information he's given from all these other people. Many people have been with the company. I mean, Nintendo's culture has been such that they have many, many people from various different parts of the company that have been around for a long time. So there's lots of people to lean on here in this difficult point.
And I don't want to say the timing was good, because obviously it wasn't good.
No.
But it is fortunate that they had finished, or that they had laid out much of what their plan was, at least internally. Because during this transition period, during this period where he is getting up to speed as CEO, there's already an action plan in place that they can follow, that they're committed to. Not just as a matter of company policy. It seems that there is a general commitment amongst staff that this is the plan we should be following. Which is good, because that means everybody has shared mission, and the CEO doesn't have to forge that mission, which is a big part of their job. If, you know, all these plans had still been in development, it would have been a much... They may not have been able to put... I don't want to say a placeholder. I don't think he's a placeholder, but they wouldn't have necessarily been able to put somebody in as an executor. They may have had to put an ideas person in there who possibly isn't ready. It's a tricky position, but I don't think you're going to see a significant change in how the company is run. I think you may see Kimishima himself be more deferential to the board, but I don't think you're going to see them just cave in and do the "what if you could pay more so Mario jumps higher."
I think it's in October, isn't it? The first
investor
relations kind of Q&A that he'll be doing is, "Oh, that'll be fun." There's so always a few, isn't
it? So I think ultimately it's going to still be the same company, because he may not know a whole lot about gaming himself, but, you know, he seems to know it decently well.
He knows the business of it at this point. Like I said, he's got
He's got years of experience at the company.
He's got the people, you know, around him that know the nuts and bolts of it, of development and all that as well. So I'm not worried about a deficit there in particular. Like I said, I mean, although he has said, you know, there's no explicit playbook that Iwata left behind for him to execute, you know, line by line, the direction of travel has been set.
Well, and it's not like Iwata was a singular person.
No, he wouldn't have, you know, it's like just this like little, you know, Bible that he kept somewhere in his desk that only
hidden
he ever
behind
saw.
A painting in the wall.
I mean, so I'm not too worried about that, but I guess it's really what comes later. When do we come to the point where, you know, the market changes, the world changes, whatever it is, and then
3 years down
like
the
you
line
said,
or something.
You're kind of like, okay, a new vision is needed.
Right.
You know, where does that come from? That's the less clear part. I mean,
and
obviously a lot of part of that will depend on how successful this phase is as well. I mean, that we have no idea of.
Well, and to a certain extent, there is, again, not a fortunate timing, but this is a good opportunity to groom a successor. Because
really for all three of them, for Takeda, for all of them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and when they did the reorg of like the dev teams, like they put names that we know in very senior positions that they were necessarily like they may have been in charge of one EAD team. Now they're in charge. Now, you know, they're co-directors of the SPD EAD merger, which is a huge development team. Like that is an enormous amount of resources.
It's interesting to me that the one kind of split that you have now with all this consolidation is you've got the actual kind of game design guys, the EPD, I think it's called, you know, the EAD, SPD fusion. And then you've basically got the firmware guys, you know, the platform kind of OS, all that kind of stuff. And I mean, because that is an area that they've lagged on, as we know, you know, they've not been on top of that stuff as much as we'd like at times. So it's interesting that it is a separate sort of department. Hopefully that's a sign of that they consider it a priority, that, you know, something they know needs to be better in future. And the fact that you have already kind of dissolved the wall between console and handheld and all that, you know, it's just going to be more of a singular focus and they'll be able to get things sort of integrated and from now on.
I do think the only real room they have to continue that kind of integration before we wrap this up is really to start when they start talking about their teams that aren't inside the mothership. It'll be interesting to see how they evolve the roles of those teams because they all, you know, intelligent systems, Monolith, a lot of those companies also do kind of platform work and game development work. So I'll be curious to see what they do with those going forward. But I mean, like I said, we don't expect to see a lot of change right off the bat. And with all these initiatives out there, I think you'll start to see names that are ultimately going to be the successor because there's lots of initiatives that need people to run them and lots of opportunities for people to distinguish themselves. Which will be, you know, a very interesting time for us to have stuff to talk about on the show.
Indeed.
All right, next email.
Okay, Dan writes, "Hey guys, love the show. My question regards the possibility of GameCube emulation on the Wii U. What do you think is the reason for not seeing it so far? Do you think it would have been possible to release a digital version as we saw with Wii releases? Or was it not possible with the Wii U architecture? I have a hard time believing that there's no possible way it could have been worked. If you think it were possible, what games would you like to have seen released digitally? Thanks a bunch."
So I could tell you that Nintendolt, which is a firmware hack that runs out of the Wii mode on the Wii U, or runs on a Wii, does launch GameCube games on Wii U. And it essentially tricks the Wii U into treating other devices as GameCube peripherals. The Wii U is physically capable of running a GameCube game, not as an emulator, just running a GameCube game.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the reason why. I think the reason why it hasn't been done comes down to money.
Well, money, not money, and is like we can charge you money for this because obviously if that was the case they would be doing it.
I just don't think they want. I think the Wii U, they look at it as kind of throwing good money after bad.
Yeah, and I think they would have to develop, you know, the architecture to essentially fake out GameCube memory cards, GameCube controllers, and it's probably not something that they view like there's a lot of GameCube games out there that would merit the demand, and they're being so cautious with the release of Wii games, that they probably just feel like, eh. I mean, they don't seem to be,
yeah,
their heart doesn't seem in it anyway. So
yeah,
I don't know what we would expect them to release, essentially.
No, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I wonder at one stage how things have gone differently, whether they may have been kind of waiting and seeing, like, maybe there's more space for, you know, Wind Waker HD type of projects, you know, rather than doing, you know, the digital re-release, let's do some fancy remake. But and you see loads of those sorts of games on the shelves for the other platforms and all,
yeah,
that. But yeah, I think with to John's point, with the Wii U struggles, that the appeal of that has probably, you know, diminished. You know, how many of those sorts of projects would actually, you know, do anything for them.
Yeah, they're kind of niche, I mean, anyways. So
I have to say, yeah, exactly.
On an even nichier console,
yeah,
probably
you
not
get, you
happen.
Know, a sort of a small slice of not a very big pie. It's, yeah, you know, it's
right,
not that appealing. But I mean, I have to say, my feeling on the possibilities for this certainly sort of drained away when you saw the fact that, you know, the way they had the Ambassador GBA games on 3DS is kind of similar to what you might imagine GameCube games working like, isn't it? You know, it's good. Well, you know, it's kind of two stages backward in the hardware, but, you know, they did it there, but they never commercialized it, did they? You know, I mean, they were,
right,
you had Ambassador games, but the only time we've been able to actually buy GBA games as a sort of digital download has been on Wii U instead of on 3DS. So it kind of suggested to me that, you know, while it might seem not that difficult, oh, you know, just plug the game in and it's fine, or it you know, it clearly is not something that they were all that interested in. Although that kind of ties into the weird narrative of them just strangling retro games on the eShop for 3DS in general,
oh,
which is a whole other subject.
Oh,
I don't suppose we shall solve here and now.
I think from a political standpoint, let's say they made it so you could buy GameCube games on the Wii U and you could download them, and they just tricked the hardware into doing, you know, recognizing, oh yeah, that classic controller pro is a GameCube controller. So I don't know that they could make it so you could play your old GameCube games, though, because the disc drive, because of that weird shaped disc. It's not like the GameCube where it had a pop-up top, or the Wii where they specially designed a drive to accept different shaped discs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know how that the Wii U's drive tray would, or the Wii U's drive would receive a GameCube game, because it is a weird shaped thing. So I'm not sure what the ramifications of them releasing, hey, you can download your games, even if you have them, you can't play them.
Well, it could be just like the PlayStation 3. They've got PlayStation 2 classics on there, and you cannot on the kind of, only on the very early PlayStation 3 models can you natively play your PlayStation 2 discs.
Yeah.
They took that away, and now they sell you the PlayStation 2 classics for $10. I don't think they would be obligated to let you play your GameCube.
But that
discs.
I mean, that was more of a hardware thing, wasn't it? Because, you know, the PS3 architecturally was radically different from the PS2.
Right.
And to achieve backwards compatibility in the first instance, they actually had to put the famous Emotion Engine or whatever in the unit.
And they repurposed it for other things.
Yeah, and they first kind of repurposed it, and then eventually, you know, especially when the 360 was doing so well, they took it out for cost reasons, and so that kind of native backward compatibility is lost. There isn't that kind of issue here, because as James mentioned, like, from a technical point of view, it's all there.
Right.
Yeah, but again, the disk drive, I think, would be the equivalent of that.
But if they had wanted to do it from the beginning,
I think the point to make with PS2 Classics, though, is that it actually took considerably more work for them to get those PS2 Classics to run digitally on PS3 systems did not have the Emotion Engine or whatever, than it would for Nintendo to do GameCube games, which I think is one of the reasons why people might find it a bit puzzling. But I think also you could maybe come back to, you know, the install base part. I mean, the PS3 has ended up with, what, like 90-some-odd million units sold or something? You know, I mean, he was a bit of a late bloomer and whatnot, but, you know, it ended up with a very healthy number. And of course, you're calling back to an install base that was even bigger with the PS2. So I think that may be sort of the disparity there.
Right. You're dealing with two niche phases of Nintendo.
Right. And the PlayStation 3 has sold better than the Wii U, and yet I remember, I think it was on the Retronauts, they had a Capcom guy on there to talk about the trombone game being a PlayStation 1 classic. And he said that those games do not make money. They really don't put the games on the service to make money. It's just kind of a fan service, fan gesture.
Right.
Of course, Capcom is third party. It would be different from Nintendo. It's very hard for me to imagine that if they were to sell, if Nintendo were to sell Mario Sunshine on the Wii U, that they would not make back, like, make some profit. But
no, that's why I'm interested about what the some of the economics of PS2 classics, you know, because it didn't come until quite late into the cycle, and
right.
it's very different in the different regions. You know, obviously in the West, you know, you've got plenty of Rockstar stuff, and then in Japan, you've got your usual kind of really more Japanese skewy stuff. So it's interesting how much that, you know, like I said, there were significant hurdles there. So you'd think they wouldn't
right.
bother if it wasn't worthwhile doing, but maybe, you know, you really are counting on the size of the install base to make that work. You know, I think with GameCube games, you know, it was a system that did not sell that well in the first place. Is key to remember. You know, 20 million or something, wasn't it?
It wasn't great.
Really, sort of roughly tied with the original Xbox, so that's kind of probably, you know, Wii U may end up somewhere similar, maybe less, I don't know. You know, there's a lot of nice games there. I would have bought some, you know, that maybe some of the ones that are harder to obtain. We kind of talked about this on and off there, I think, a little bit about, you know, some of these games for Retroactive that, you know, are maybe not that accessible because
right.
of the GameCube stuff. It's a shame in that way. There's certainly a number of GameCube games at the time, you know, I was still importing, so it wasn't cheap to buy these games. I passed on that I would still have interest in. And, you know, if he was talking about a download that was, you know, in the same sort of range that those PS2 classics are, although based on, you know, maybe the same sort of maybe a little cheaper than the Wii downloads are. You know, I'd be perfectly interested to try stuff like, I mean, certainly Baten Kaitos is something I'd both
awesome.
Games. I'd be
yeah.
interested in looking at that. Star Fox. Star Fox
games.
Assault is not, you know, meant to be great, but it's a Star Fox game I've never played. Like,
and
I would
it's
love
hard to get.
I would love to play it, but it is actually surprisingly expensive to get as a disc. So, I mean, there's no shortage of games I'd be interested in, because, I mean, for some reason, if it's older, it's instantly more attractive to me.
Yeah.
I get make your jokes now.
I mean, I'd like to play Time Splitters again. Love Time Splitters.
Like, I've tried to shop for GameCube games, and yeah, they're still really expensive. So I've said on this podcast that I plan to get Kirby Air Ride. I still haven't. I plan to get Four Swords.
That's
I still haven't.
Really good...
Of course, that would be hard to emulate.
Yeah, I actually got that relatively recently. I got the Japanese Four Swords Adventures and played through it all naturally in one play. You know, and it's good fun.
Actually,
nice.
You know, that brings a good point. A lot of these Japanese GameCube games that just didn't come out here because they're too damn weird.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, Hudson had a whole line of these weird GameCube games that just never came out here.
Right, a bunk remake.
I just recently got a sealed new copy of that Treasure Dragon Drive for dirt cheap.
Oh my god.
Wow.
It's meant to be garbage. So I think it's one of the only games they don't acknowledge actually having made on their website. Or like,
that's really funny.
And it's like not everything they made that great that they do acknowledge. So it must be terrible. I couldn't resist. It's like, it's new, it's sealed, it's a tenner. I can't resist this. Almost every Treasure game on the Nintendo platform ever made.
Well, speaking of Treasure Ikaruga.
That
makes sense.
Yeah,
that's actually a good one. Yeah, and I mean, that is ridiculously expensive. Considering that's on XBLA, I cannot believe how expensive
it's
the
weird.
Physical copy is of that. It
how
makes
much are
no
they?
Sense to me at all. And I love Treasure.
Yeah, I mean, any of those games that came out that kind of went with the whimper, that were like those weird GameCube RPGs that never really caught.
Rogue Squadron 3 is a good one because, you know, I had Rogue Squadron 2 at launch. You know, it wasn't quite a launch, but when I got the system, loved it. Big Star Wars guy, all that. But again, it's expensive, imported games. And third one, you know, caught a fair amount of crap for the on foot sections, which are apparently just total
it's
travesty.
Not great.
You know, but if you're talking about a modest download, you know, I'd be willing to.
And it contains the entire the entire second game.
As as a co-op game.
Yes.
So, you know, you could have that. I mean, all those sorts of things which, you know, at the time, I know GameCube didn't have, like, the most software of the platforms at the time, but there were quite a few games that was kind of like, eh, close but no cigar. You know, Kirby's Air Ride.
Chibi Robo.
Rogue Squadron. Chibi Robo, I ended up getting on Wii. But that yeah, was there's Chibi another Robo one that passed
and,
me by.
God, what was that other weird game they made? Cubivore.
Yeah,
stuff like that that just came out in tiny numbers. Would be just, yeah, there is a market for both big games here and games that like nobody ever got a chance to play. So
F-Zero GX, Jungle Beat. I'm just going through the
Well, Jungle Beat would be hard because of the peripherals.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's the new, they've done the Wii. They'll probably re-release the new Play Control version of that. Which, it's not that bad, but it's not like playing the original.
It's not the same.
It's not. I mean, in some ways, it's more approachable, because I think it just put people off the whole, you know, but when you got it down, it was a hell of a lot of fun.
Yeah.
There was quite a lot of peripheral stuff on the GameCube as well. Obviously, we've talked about Adama.
Yeah,
that Mario Party game with the microphone.
And the microphone, yeah.
So it's Fire Emblem Path of Radiance.
That game is expensive as hell.
Giftpia is another weird, kind of like oddball one from Skip.
Yeah.
Giftpia.
But that was never translated, right? I think it was fan translated.
Fan translated, yeah.
In Japan, right. Mm. Yep.
All right, before this turns into John reading the Wikipedia page, I'm going to skip to the last email today because we got some wrap-up stuff to do. And I'm going to go ahead and read that. In the weirdly accusatory question of the week, Ben C. from Detroit, Michigan writes, "Dear John, why is it acceptable for Donkey Kong to walk around wearing only a tie? Why is it okay for Shulk to run around in his underwear yelling, 'I'm really feeling it!' as if he were at Bonnaroo, but when I do it, I get a call from HR and a sexual harassment lawsuit?"
Well, I mean, I'm assuming you don't have an entirely furred body.
Well, yeah, Shulk has no hair on his body at all.
Yeah,
John.
That's true. But well, the fact
Shulk bikini waxes.
He's a male specimen, though. That guy, you know, the ladies love that guy.
Donkey Kong is overdressed wearing Shulks. The tie, so that's a whole other thing. And we did, it was sort of, I think we already knew this, but the release of some of those old, rare kind of behind-the-scenes stuff confirmed that Miyamoto had kind of conceived of him wearing the tie. if you want to blame someone, you blame the big man, the software czar.
Because he just sits around thinking of gorillas and ties.
John, so... you're saying if you are a specimen, you could run around in a tie in your underwear.
Well, you see, that's the thing. Everybody has like kind of like a baseline that they start from, right? DK, when he throws on a tie, he's churching
it up.
He's dressing it up. Shulk, I mean, Shulk, the ladies want to see Shulk with his clothes off. I'm just saying it. The ones that I've talked to, they're like, oh, Shulk, I love him so much. I'm really feeling it.
So, Jesus Christ.
It's just ones I talk to. About
Xenoblade
characters.
Every lady talks to.
About Xenoblade
characters.
We're a tight-knit community.
To be fair, I really think Ryan is underappreciated for his masculinity. So, remember, in Xenoblade, you could dress everybody up like Shulk in Smash Brothers. So, if you're so inclined. But that's going to do it for email this week. You can send your emails, your questions, your music suggestions, and your weirdly accusatory emails of the week to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. That's rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. I said I was going to read it twice, and I did. Also, I'm going to remind you that our winner for the retroactive poll for the Mario Maker inspired, not in Mario Maker retroactive, was Mario Tennis Power Tour, which is currently available on the Wii U Virtual Console as a GBA game. That's got some RPG elements to it, some story progression, so you might want to get started on that one fairly soon. We'll announce the date for the retroactive, but you should expect it to be fairly soon at hand.
Remember, James, if you don't deliver Stan, I'm rescinding my vote.
I didn't know that, but okay.
I said it explicitly! I will throw it all in the chaos. I'm putting you under the buzzer. You are going to have to get it done.
All right, I will talk to Mr. Ferguson and make that happen. Stan, if you're listening, which you're not, I want you to start practicing telling me why Mario Tennis Power Tour is a magical experience. Carl, if you're listening, text Dan and tell him to start practicing why Mario Tennis Power Tools have experience. John, if you're listening, text Carl to text Dan. All right. So, also, there's a... We'll be continuing to produce some Mario Maker levels, so please follow us. You can find links to us, our profiles, in the last page. I'll include them in the show notes for this one too, just as kind of a reminder. Maybe I'll just include some level IDs so you can follow us instead. Just whatever ends up being easiest for you guys to get to us in a completely nonviolent way. So, on that, do we have any other plugs? I don't think we do.
No, thanks to all the various people that have started following me on Miiverse last time, because of the fact that we gave out our IDs last time. You will find I don't post much.
No.
sorry,
you remain a mysterious figure.
But sorry, it was a bit bait and switchy, but, you know, hope the creative well hasn't quite run dry yet in Mario Maker, but considering people just seem to think that my levels are malicious when they're not, I don't know.
I think the average clue percentage for all stages in the entire thing is like 10, so don't worry about it. You're good to go.
Greg, you're the Nintendo Kaiser Soze. A mythical figure.
I do walk around with a limp for no reason other than just pretending.
Alright, that's going to do it. First, have our end music. Given the I won't call it unfortunate. I'm going to say possibly a good decision to delay.
It could be for the best.
Star Fox Zero until next year. You know, we were looking forward to it, but hopefully the game we end up with will be all the better for the delay. Today's ending music is the main theme from the original Star Fox for the Super Nintendo. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Matrix.